So we can look back in time by looking very far back at distance. And then if we can look at objects that are very far away, of course, the further away they are, the dimmer they get. And so when you look at the brightness of an object that you know, its intrinsic brightness, you just look at the dimming. That tells you how far away it is. That tells you how far ago an object existed. The size of the universe, on the other hand, you can determine by looking at an object's color. So as the universe expands, as light travels to us from a distant source, the wavelength of light gets stretched out with the size of the universe. And it creates what we call a redshift. So if you look at the spectrum of an astrophysical object, look at its spectral lines, all the spectral lines will be shifted to the red end of the spectrum as the universe expands. So when you're looking at a graph of, say, the color of objects versus their brightness, you're actually looking at a graph of the size of the universe over time. It's very important. You need to get this because we're using these terms a lot, redshift.
How do you tell the difference between something that's dim because it's far away and something that's dim because it's not very energetic?
That's the key to this whole argument. So let's go on. So the reason that we can distinguish between something being dim and close versus bright and far away is that there's a special type of object called a type 1a supernova, shown here. There's a particular type of exploding star that's extremely regular. So almost the same way every time when you see explode almost the same way every time. The key thing is that when you see one, you know very well how bright it is. Therefore, by measuring its observed brightness, you get a very good indication of how far away it is. And you can see that they're incredibly bright. And one exploding star has a comparable luminosity to an entire galaxy made of billions of stars. So these things go way out there. You can see up to 10 billion light years away. And so distance redshift measurements, or luminosity redshift measurements of these type 1a supernova have allowed us to track the expansion of the universe over time. And we get this picture rather than this picture. It seems that the expansion rate was slower in the past rather than faster in the past. At the same time, other independent observations, in particular the cosmic microwave background, seem to be implying that there's a missing energy component to the universe. So for instance, here's what the sky would look like if you had microwave eyes. And observations of the microwave sky can actually give you an idea for the total net shape of the universe, whether it's positively curved. Can you even see my pointer here?
Want a new one?
There's the hockey stick is the best pointer.
I would use a hockey stick. Now I feel like
welcome to Canada.
Yes. the universe can have a positive curvature, in which parallel light rays eventually converge. It can have a negative curvature, where parallel light rays eventually diverge. Or it could be perfectly flat, where parallel light rays stay parallel, like you learned in geometry class. And observations of the microwave sky tell us that we live in a universe that looks more like this, which is puzzling because in order to get this shape depends on the energy density of the universe. So there's a critical energy that the universe must have in order for it to be flat. Too much energy and it will go positive, too little energy and it will go negative. So there seems to be just enough energy in the universe to make it flat. And yet, all other observations indicate that the amount of matter in the universe falls way short of that amount. So we have direct evidence that the universe is accelerating. We have indirect evidence that there is something else out there. And we have some explanations, but maybe not the explanation. So within general relativity, the evidence is explained by positing the existence of something called dark energy. Dark energy is supposed to be an invisible, smooth substance with negative pressure. So we call it dark because it's invisible, meaning it doesn't interact with light, except maybe gravitationally. It's smooth because it doesn't clump into interesting objects like matter does. And the negative pressure thing, I'll explain why we think that is on the next slide. The simplest possible explanation, I have simplest in quotes, is that dark energy is Einstein's cosmological constant, or the energy of the vacuum empty state. I say it's simple because this would be just one number of the cosmological constant, or the energy density of vacuum. But I put it in quotes because so far all attempts to compute this number have been unsuccessful. So if you naively try to use the standard model to compute value for the energy density of empty space, you either get something that is infinite or something that's just ridiculously too big, something like 50 orders of magnitude above what you actually need for the observations. So so there's a problem with the simplest explanation, but the simplest explanation seems to be very, very well supported by the data. So here we have constraints on the density of vacuum energy versus the density of matter, and it's given in units of the density needed to make the universe flat. You see the cosmic microwave background tells us that the two parameters have such a proportion as to make the universe flat. Supernovae tell us that the two components have a proportion that are enough to make the universe accelerate instead of decelerate. And there are independent lines of evidence that seem to be converging on this answer here, which is that the universe, if you consider it to be vacuum energy, the universe seems to be made of about 73% dark energy, and the rest made up of matter. But even of the matter, only 4% of that is stuff we know about atoms. The rest is something called cold dark matter, which is a type of particle that we haven't identified, also not interacting with light. But this talk is going to focus more on dark energy. So this seems to be the picture as long as you assume that dark energy is the cosmological constant. It doesn't have to be the cosmological constant. It could have its own dynamics. It can be, you know, a scalar field that changes in time and has little fluctuations in it. Some people call that quintessence. There are various other dark energy models, too many to list here. But the thing that you should take away is that general relativity requires dark energy to, you know, fill up this pie. General relativity implies that there's extra component out there. But the standard model does not provide a viable dark energy candidate. So something's got to give. Either we need some sort of extension of the standard model, or GR might be breaking down. And it's the latter possibility that I'm going to focus on for a minute. But before I move on, this is my cosmology intro. So are there any general questions about cosmology, dark energy, vacuum energy, anything like that?
Dark energy is supposed to be just uniformly distributed through space, right? Because it's just energy that's somewhere in the vacuum.
If it's vacuum energy, it would be uniformly distributed. It would just be a constant density everywhere. But there are models that say that it can change.
Okay, so, all right, what I'm getting at here is there's the argument for cold dark matter, which says that it basically forms big spherical shells in galaxies and gives you the flattening of rotation curves, right? So is that the only sort of line of evidence that says you've got cold dark matter and dark energy rather than everything being explainable by just one single phenomenon? Where's the sort of killer explanation that says you have to have dark energy and cold dark matter?
Well, one of them is, so for instance, cluster data. So the observation of these objects, gravitational observations of large objects where you can figure out their virial properties, figure out the gravitational pull on the things around it. So that tells you the total amount of stuff that is gravitating in those objects without regards to what the stuff is. And so even that number falls way short. So independent constraints that measure only gravitating objects still come up way short of the total you need that seems to be converging up here.
So the weird thing about dark energy seems to be it's got negative pressure. Do we know of any other thing in our scientifically observable universe that has that property, or is this a totally new thing?
Spring. So negative pressure is something that increases its energy when you compress it. Positive pressure would be something like a balloon that increases its energy when you compress it. Negative pressure would be something that increases its energy when you try to pull it apart.
So
mean, a spring goes both ways, but if you think of an elastic object, you need to add energy to make it bigger. So that would be called negative pressure in this case. And the way that factors in with dark energy is that if the energy of empty space is a constant, then as the universe expands, gets bigger, you're just adding more space to the universe, which means your energy is going up. This is a very hand-wavy argument. You really need to walk through the general relativity to really get it, but that's essentially it.
Are you saying there's actually something inconsistent about this lambda CDN model? In other words, you just say that there is a particular value of lambda. We don't understand where it comes from.
So you can measure lambda. So you can take this density, translate it into a physical density, and write that down. Then you can use, say, quantum field theory and try to predict what is the density of empty space by summing up all possible modes, all possible particles. And when you do the latter, you get something that is way wrong.
I'm not sure anyone has ever really done that calculation, but even if they did, there's another free parameter in the model, which is just the bare constant. It's just part of the gravitation theory.
Sure, but then there's no explanation for that. It's just a fine-tuning thing. If you're, it's not even, you know.
It's not an explanation.
Yeah.
I'm just asking if you say there's an inconsistency or just a lack.
Oh, no, it's just a lack of explanation. Yeah, the cosmological constant as observed. If you wanted to predict it using dimensional analysis, it would have units of the Planck max. But it is, you know, not even remotely close to being the Planck max. So you've got a fine-tuning product. So sure, you can say it's just a number, but then people will bug you to ask where that number came from. And why isn't it natural?
There's plenty of those hierarchy problems.
Yes, right. So one more thing the standard model does not explain. Also, let me recap what we were talking about. So, right, so something's got to give. GR requires dark energy. The standard model does not provide something viable in terms of dark energy. So, I'm going to consider the possibility that maybe there's something wrong with GR. So, in GR, you have Einstein's equation inscribed lovingly here in PowerPoint. And Einstein's equation provides the Friedmann equation, which is what links cosmic expansion to cosmic energy and pressure. So, very schematically, the Friedmann equation says this. It says the second time derivative of physical distances, by which I mean the distance between any two objects that are very far apart, say two galaxies on opposite sides of the sky. The second time derivative of that is proportional to minus rho plus 3p, where rho is the total energy density of the universe, and p is the total pressure. So you can see if you have something with a lot of negative pressure, you get this thing to go positive. And make the acceleration of the universe positive. So like I said, acceleration in GR requires a significant amount of dark energy with W, which is defined as P over rho, to be less than minus a third. As I showed you on the other slide, the observations are consistent with this picture. But if GR is wrong, then cosmic expansion could proceed in a different way. It could depend on the energy components in a different way or not entirely. And so the picture that I showed you before, which was based on dark energy existing, you have to throw that out. And there are alternatives to GR. There are possibilities of extra dimensions that, you know, gravity could be leaking into extra dimensions and weakening on large scales. There are these F of R theories, which add terms to the GR Lagrangian besides the simplest one that Einstein picked out. There are these tensor vector scalar models that add new gravitational fields into the mix. I mean, we know that eventually we want to combine GR on the standard model into something like quantum gravity. So maybe the answer is going to be automatically solved when you solve that problem. Yes?
Immediately, I have nothing wrong.
Nothing wrong with the cosmological principle?
Yeah. In your approach, you just think GR is wrong or the standard model is wrong. But we know our universe is not homogeneous. Mm-hmm. And it's tropic. So you think is dark energy is from tangents of multiple ones?
So the question is, could I just be taking the cosmological principle for granted? The cosmological principle is a rule of thumb that says that there is no special place or time in the universe. There's no special point in space-time. For instance, it is not the case that we are just at the center of some huge explosion and we can see all the galaxies and stuff receding from us. The universe, if you find yourself positing that you live in a special place or at a special time, you're usually wrong, just historically. And you're arguing that maybe the universe is not perfectly homogeneous or isotropic, and that we live in some sort of special place that makes the universe look like it's accelerating, but it's really an illusion based on our special circumstances. So first I want to say that the universe is very homogeneous and isotropic to a very large degree, and the cosmic microwave background shows us a picture of the early universe that is only only fluctuating on at a part in 10 to the 5. We also have measurements from you know, things that are more nearby that also give a very good indication the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. But people do consider these things. And that's not something I've studied, so I can't. I mean, it is possible, but very improbable.
So if you consider that you are in a local void, a large void, then it's got to be a very large scale, larger than 100 megaparsec. Then you can account for the acceleration. If you were to see it in the center of a very large void, then you could look at a supernovae like we do and find them mimicking the behavior of acceleration. But then that implies a breakdown of the cosmological principle.
I was going the way of VR being wrong. So I was positing that there are these other theories of gravity. You don't have to memorize all of them. But the problem could be with GR and not with the Stanford model. So imagine the following situation. You wake up one morning and you pick up your favorite copy of the Des Moines Tribune and you read that general relativity has been falsified. Breaking news. For some reason, this causes America to invade a country.
Everything else does.
Yeah, it's what we're good at.
Charles, this is not quite the same joke on the side of the border.
I think this is Algeria, actually.
Another well-rich country like this one.
So you start thinking to yourself, well, my God, I mean, I don't know what to believe anymore. Is the universe even accelerating? Because so much of the evidence for the acceleration comes from this picture where you assume a particular dark energy model and then use the fact that there is so much dark energy and energy and it makes the universe accelerate that you conclude that the universe is accelerating. Once you figure out that, well, now gravity has changed, you may want to rethink your argument and figure out, is the universe actually accelerating? Can we say that a little more robustly? So in addition to constraining dark energy in gravity models, I think we should be forming robust conclusions about the observed universe. So you want to try to figure out, what can you say about the observations that depend on as few assumptions as possible? So as you add assumptions, you know where
to go. Why do you say it would force us necessarily to doubt that we're accelerating? In a sense that supernovae give you a geometric pulse. As long as there's a single metric coupling to all the metric fields.
I mean, it's not in the bag, is all I'm saying. That if there's nothing that since this was the argument, and now you're changing your argument, I'm going to now strengthen the argument that the universe is accelerating using those techniques. So Michael Turner and I wrote a paper called What We Really Know About Cosmic Acceleration, which we tried to say as strong statements as possible about the acceleration while using as few assumptions as possible. So the assumptions that we start with is that we live on a flat, homogeneous, isotropic spacetime. And I assume flatness, that you know there's no theoretical justification for that, but you cannot get constraints otherwise. So it's purely for convenience. So here's a metric of the universe. It has, you know, it's flat with some factor that controls the distances between objects as a function of time. A is called the scale factor. And we assume that the usual geodesic equation holds, so that as the universe expands, light is redshifted in the normal way, as you expect. And redshift z is related to the expansion factor of the universe by this equation. Then we just define these expansion parameters that have nothing to do with the theory of gravity, nothing to do with any sort of dynamics. So there's the Hubble parameter, which is proportional to the first derivative of the scale. And there's this deceleration parameter, q, which is proportional to minus the second derivative of the scale. So when q is negative, the universe is accelerating. And without using anything from a theory of gravity, you can calculate the distance redshift with the luminosity redshift relationship directly from these parameters. You can pick one or the other. And so this is called a kinematic model rather than kinematic parameterization rather than dynamic. And so supernovae are still standard candles, so we can still measure their distances by the luminosity and the redshifts, and we compare that to data. So we took this approach and compared what we did to the gold set from Rees et al., from paper in 2004, that used 157 supernovae out to a redshift of 1.76, with about a dozen coming from the Hubble Space Telescope. So we ask questions like, did the universe ever really accelerate or decelerate? Excuse me. So you can fit these kinematic models to the data. So here I'm showing the deceleration parameter q as a function of redshift z. Remember, the universe accelerates when q is negative. And you can say fit a line to the data. So not to the data, but assume that q is a line. So assume that the acceleration follows some linear model in redshift. When you fit that model to the data, you get this. So it clearly shows that the universe is accelerating today. There was a transition, and it decelerated in the past. Oh, I'm using jargon. As you go to higher and higher redshift, you're obviously going to higher and higher distances, and therefore you go back in time. Sometimes I use high redshift to mean time. So the linear model shows that the universe went from decelerating to accelerating. We have to ask, do you believe that? Because what if we had measured this, or what if we had fit this to the data? So if it had selected a model that accelerates today and then transitions over to deceleration at z of 2, well, the data didn't even go out to z of 2. So you would conclude that, well, that transition is just something that's implied by your model. It didn't really actually come from the data. The fact that we do have data in this area makes us, you know, confident that, you know, this is a little close to reality, but it's still a little sketchy. Another thing you can do is fit a two-zone model. So, for instance, you know, the acceleration is something at one epoch and something else at another epoch, piecewise continue, piecewise flat. And that picks this totally different history with the same goodness of fit. It seems like there's a lot of acceleration today, moderate amount of deceleration in the past, with a transition that was very recent.
So the three parameters that you're fitting there are just two, or no, well,
three, I guess. The data are not constraining enough to use all three, so I fit these two parameters, Q0 and Q1, for various the transitions, and this one has the best goodness of fit. So there's another simple model that indicates the universe was decelerating in the past and accelerating today. But once again, you're suspicious that maybe these are just artifacts of our models, that we are forcing this answer because we're just not being creative enough with how to ground type the data. And I should mention that these models fit the data as well as Lambda CDM. So the Lambda CDM history, decelerating the past, accelerating today, is shown here for scale. I'm going to go way over, so I'm going to skip some of this. But so you start to wonder which features are real and which features are just true to the model. And the conclusion was our paper was an argument that I'm not going to get into because it's a little more technical. But we argue that there is real 5-sigma evidence for the acceleration of the universe that's independent of any model, and that the acceleration of the universe is probably not constant in time. And if people want to use this argument, I can maybe come back later, but I don't think I'm going to have time. I've just been mentioning these.
So if it's not constant, which way is it going?
Up in the past.
Towards the past. So
if it's not constant, it's probably decelerating in the past. Well, it was less accelerative in the past. But it's I don't think we can say with certainty that it actually ever crossed zero.
So it's as if the vacuum energy was increasing.
No. So just because the universe was decelerating in the past doesn't mean there was no dark energy in the past. It just means that the matter was more prevalent than dark energy, but matter dilutes, whereas dark energy is constant.
Can I just ask you, what's the general thing about the following? So if I change the scale, like instead of the redshift, I try something linear in time or something else, would you expect much different results or?
There was a paper recently by Eric Linder who said that the results do depend somewhat on the choice of the parameter that you used, march time forward. But time sort of is arbitrary. I don't know, it just feels like redshift or scale factor, so these are more physical. But the answer to your question is yes, could make a difference. So I talked about all these gravity models and ways of testing things that are independent of gravity models and way of testing gravity models, because I want to start doing this with gravitational lensing, which is going to be the second half of my talk, but I've already taken half an hour. So how long do you think I can take for now?
5, 7 minutes plus questions.
7 minutes for questions, okay. I'm going to skip a lot. So we were looking at how supernovae tell us the expansion of the universe. You can also do these things with gravitational lenses. So hopefully you're familiar with the fact that gravity bends light. So we have a source in the distant universe. Sends out a light ray, which is deflected by a gravitational lens. It comes to our eye. And you don't have to remember this equation, but I just want you to see that the deflection depends on both the mass of the deflector and on the impact parameter. And the impact parameter can be expressed as ratios of distances between us and the source and between the lens and the source. And so dark energy, obviously, by setting the acceleration of the universe, is going to change the distances between objects, between sources, lenses, and observers. So that's one way it's going to change light deflection. Dark energy can also interfere with structure formation, by which I mean that it slows the clumping of matter, so it's going to prevent lots of massive structures from forming. So in these two ways, you get two handles on dark energy by looking at gravitational lenses. And so you might think that, a possibility is to change gravity. If you change gravity, then you're changing the way mass deflects light. But actually, if you're clever, you can construct observables that are independent of that part of the equation. So for instance, if I measure the deflection of two sources by the same object, then I can, say, take the ratio of the two deflections, alpha, and n cancels out, for n is the same, and then I just get a parameter that only depends on distances. So using gravitational lensing, it is possible to construct these observables that will isolate distance information and turn lensing into a kinematic probe, the kind that I was talking about before. Or you can include the information about structure. Don't throw the M away, you know, solve for M or something such like that. And then use that to test your alpha gravity theories. So this is something that I'm getting interested in now. It's not something that I was going to talk about. I was just going to talk more about weak lensing in general. So let me think. What am I going to have time for? I'll just give you an introduction to weak lensing, and anyone is interested in what I did to further this noble quest, you can ask me in person. So there are two types of gravitational lensing, as far as I'm concerned, strong and weak. Strong is the type that uses beautiful pictures of, you know, objects that have been multiply imaged by some lens in the center. So these four objects here are called the, you know, Einstein gravitational, Einstein cross. These are actually four images of the same object. You get these beautiful arced features here, these distorted galaxies. Weak lensing is not nearly that beautiful. In weak lensing, you have an object that's already slightly elliptical, and you're just changing its ellipticity. And it's very hard to tell when that happens, because the effect is very slight. Even this is highly exaggerated. The actual effect of weak lensing is just to change the ellipticity of an object by a tiny amount. And so you can't tell by looking at one object whether or not it's been weakly lensed. You have to look at millions and millions of objects and average over them. And that doesn't give you cool pictures like this. So we have picture envy, and we have to invent ridiculous diagrams like this. So this is supposed to illustrate weak lensing, where there are lots of galaxies in the back with certain shapes. These galaxies emit light that travel through the universe. They travel past all the matter and dark matter and are lensed by it. And then if you look at lots of them, you can't tell whether one of them has had its shape distorted, but a clump of them will have their shapes aligned in a particular direction. That's how that allows you to figure out what happened in between. An important thing about weak lensing is that it provides a direct probe of the matter distribution in the universe. So consider this as an analogy. If you wanted to figure out where all the people lived on the Earth, you could maybe make an argument based on light. That, you know, oh, look at North America. It seems that all these heavily populated areas seem to have the most light coming from them. So maybe light is proportional to population. Then you would look at the world and say, well, then there are clearly more people in America than in India and China, which is not right. And a similar thing holds for the universe. The universe is made up of matter and dark matter, and dark matter makes up most of it. And you can't just figure out where all the dark matter is by looking at the matter, because even though it traces it to some extent, it doesn't trace it perfectly. You can't just see a collection of luminous galaxies and conclude that's where all the dark matter is. Whereas if you look at the lensed effect of those galaxies, you look at distortion, the distorted images do trace mass. So by looking at gravitational lensing, you really are getting a picture of the total matter distribution of the universe. I'm not going to talk about that. I just want to say that weak lensing experiments are coming along. It's a 21st century science. The first weak lensing measurements were done in the year 2000, first cosmic shear measurements were made in the year 2000. And in the next decade or so, there are going to be these great experiments, including the supernova acceleration probe, which will do these huge sky surveys and collect millions of galaxies and allow us to get high-precision measurements of the lensing and dark energy parameters based on that. I was going to talk about all the things that you could do to get ready for that. And so I've worked on some projects that have refined the predictions of weak lensing to get them ready for dark matter, dark energy experiments. But I'm going way over. So I'll just conclude. The possibility of gravity modification requires us to take a hard look at what we know in cosmology. Weak lensing's dependence on multiple gravitational effects make it a powerful probe of dark energy in gravity models. And the part I didn't cover so much, but you can talk to me about, is for future weak lensing surveys to be fully effective, theorists must remain vigilant for little things that can trip up their predictions. And most people like to motivate their talks at the beginning, and I like to motivate mine at the end. Thank you.
So, putting everything and all care aside, what do you think we're observing?
What do you think the dark energy is?
Yes.
So anyone who says that they know is not UBS.
I said think.
Yeah. So, I mean, my favorite explanation is that it's quantum gravity, that when we figure out how to unify gravity and quantum mechanics, there will be some strange effects that will pop out, and that will give maybe a predictable value of a cosmological constant or something. But that's just speculating.
So a large distance quantum gravity.
Or something that fine-tunes or naturally fine-tunes the vacuum energy some way.
We can talk more about that.
Sure. It
can be something related to the cosmology of Casimir effect, for example.
Also, the Casimir effect shows us that vacuum energy exists. So, I mean, that's another reason why vacuum energy is, you know, in the running for best explanation of dark energy, because we know there is vacuum energy from the Casimir effect. But the Casimir effect does not tell you the ground state of that energy. And it's the ground state that we're observing, if it is.
This is a slight misconception. The Casimir effect doesn't really prove that the vacuum energy exists. It can be explained by fluctuating dipoles on the boundaries. Casimir quantum force was derived by Casimir without any reference to vacuum energy. This is, I hear it often, but it's
okay. So what I said was not true at all.
No, wait, I have to contradict that a bit, because instead of having two plates, you could also have periodic boundary condition compactify this way, and there are no charges that would fluctuate, and you still have a fact.
Well, Casimir force can be explained by physical fluctuations of charges.
Well, that's right, if you have plates,
but I'm just saying that's all.
Maybe you can take, maybe 2 minutes and tell us a bit more about your weak lensing results.
Yeah, sure.
You can take those 3 if you want. It's fine.
Is the next talk ready?
Well, we'll take a coffee break after this instead.
So what I wanted to say is that we're going to get some really fantastic experimental results in the near future. We're going to be able to, for instance, with weak lensing, measure the W parameter in dark energy, to within 10%, which is fantastic. But that hinges on the ability of theorists to be able to predict the weak lensing observables. So I've worked on some things that take a look at various things that can trip up the weak lensing predictions.
Sorry, why did the cow have 6 legs?
There were 6 things. Yeah, that was a great joke. So one thing we looked at, I looked at with Asafa Kure, was lens-lens coupling. So if you're here and there's some source here, light travels to you along a curved path via a lensing, And if you just consider two sources, or two gravitational potentials, there will be two distortions of the light. And it's important to remember that we don't care about the path of the light, we care about a distortion. And by distortion, I mean whether or not a bundle of light rays has been magnified or demagnified, or what we do for shear measurements from weak gravitational lensing, whether a bundle of light rays has been sheared to one side, has been switched, which would cause a galaxy image to get an ellipticity. So, you know, the distortion of your eyes, the sum of distortions that the bundle of light rays experienced along its whole trip, and strictly speaking, it's equal to a sum over the total distortion is equal to a sum of distortions with some coupling. And that coupling is typically ignored in the canonical calculation. And so we looked at, you know, if we go back and iteratively include this coupling, what does that do to the prediction? And we found that when you calculate the correction for Lenz-Lenz coupling, that it's totally negligible. And this has been confirmed. We did it analytically. It's also been confirmed using simulations. So here is an example of a simulation, a big box of particles that are, tell the computer how to work gravity and just let particles fly. And then you send light rays through them, and you try to figure out the shear signal from that. And in 2003, Dale and White did a simulation and showed that. So here's a measure of the distortion of 42 million light rays. And it shows that most of them are well below. So this is a threshold for the distortion. So this shows that most of them are well below even 0.01. Here, you know, 1 is big and 0.01 is small.
Sorry, Chad. I was under the assumption that it was based on the Lenz-Lenz coupling that you let with the tomography, based on the correlation between two lenses, different redshifts, and it's avoided by the
Well, using Lenz-Lenz information at multiple redshifts is what allows you to, you know, do that argument that I said before, where you're gaining distance information from the lenses, and also you're also watching structure form over time. But this is something different. I'm talking about a single bundle of light rays. How does its distortion by this object depend on its previous distortions? I lost my train of thought. So this, I'm not going to go into this table, but simulations have shown that also that its effect is small. Another thing I looked at was called the Born approximation. In the Born approximation, so here's the true path of the light ray x. And for the purposes of calculation, in the Born approximation, you assume that the light ray was actually a straight line. And you assume that the distortions along that line were pretty close to distortions along the actual trip that the bundle took. The way I've drawn it here, it looks like that's crazy. That would never work. But it does. So not going to go into the calculation, but that's another correction that is negligible for now. Last thing I looked at, so I showed you two corrections that were kind of complicated, and they turned out not to matter. Here's one that's very simple. It turns out it matters a lot. I've been talking about shear. The quantity that actually takes a spherical object and makes it elliptical is not the shear. What's observed is actually something called reduced shear. The reduced shear g is proportional to the shear divided by 1 minus kappa, and kappa tells you the magnification of the galaxy. And so you just tailor expand this, you know, it's roughly equal to kappa. But you can perturb around, you know, small values, you know, take the fact that weak lensing is weak, and write expansion now. I didn't get to talk about power spectra, but you want to look at 2-point functions of shear. You get this extra 3-point term, which turns out to be quite large. It can change the ratio of the shear power spectrum to the reduced shear power spectrum by as much as 10% on interesting scales. So it's a very simple thing that turns out to have huge consequences. Needs to be taken into account for these future reflexing surveys.
So I think we should move to the coffee break. And
to be clear, what we're going to do is we're going to take the coffee break now to allow the IT people to get all the stars aligned. And while we're doing that, and then we're going to have the three talks. And so